We've been reading through, as you know, this series on the book of Daniel, and throughout that has come a couple of overriding themes that Mike's covered up until now, one of which is the sovereignty of God in all of historical affairs, in our own lives and in all the events that we've seen as played out in the history as told by Daniel in this book. One of the other themes that we've been bringing through here is surviving, as it were, as Christians, as disciples of Christ in an otherwise hostile world. And there's been a number of scenes that we've read already, the story of Daniel and his friends who have been imposed upon to eat the royal food, how they were called upon to interpret dreams and threatened with being thrown into a furnace. Thanks, Chris, that's perfect, we'll leave it up there. And how Daniel is going to come to another challenge very shortly in the reading we're going to go through. I'm actually meant to be covering Daniel chapter 6, which has probably one of the best known children's Bible stories that you'll ever run across. So I thought it'd be a bit of a waste of time having Catherine read the story of Daniel and the lions. I thought I'd just have a little bit of context to explain the lead up to the scene where we see Daniel being given over to the lion's den. That, as I say, a very famous story where Daniel's faith put in him the courage and the hope that he would be protected no matter what God might bring upon his life. In some sense, Daniel, we're going to talk a bit about how his track record of faithful following of God, his proven worthiness as a worker in the kingdom, and his love for God laid a foundation for him to deal with that challenge that came into his life later on. And it kind of reminds me of a story I heard a while ago of a family who had chartered a boat to go out on a trip one day, and the captain, before they even headed off, it was a beautiful sunny day, and before they cast off from the pier, the captain knelt and prayed. And this family going, "What are you doing? What are you praying for? Everything's perfectly fine here. Are you worried? Why are you praying now when everything's sunny and fine and going to be a great day?" You know, the captain said, "Just thought we should." Later that day, a storm brewed up. Things got a bit hairy, and the captain straight away got to work doing what he had to do with, I don't know all the nautical terms, David probably helped me out on this sort of stuff, about how one responds in the time of a storm. And the family going, "Wow, he was right to pray beforehand, because now's the time for action." This captain had decided, before anything else happened, that he should first of all commit what he does and pray and give strength into his life and to commit himself even when things are good, so that for him, when the storms came up, when the difficulty literally came along, he knew he'd already spoken to God about it. He'd laid that foundation of knowing he can trust God in all those aspects of his life. So the sovereignty of God, the surviving in a hostile world are the themes that we've been covering so far in Daniel. So the reading we had this morning, a fair bit of time has actually passed since the end of Daniel chapter 4, when Mike talked about how Nebuchadnezzar, in his arrogance, in his pride at how he had built Babylon to be such a great and powerful city, and his empire was so huge, God humbled him, and part of that story is actually retold in Daniel's speech to Belshazzar that day when those words appeared on the wall there. So a bit of time's passed by. We have Belshazzar, and it says here that he was having a big party. He was the successor to King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, I want to try and give you a little bit of historical context and bring you up to speed about what's happened between the end of Nebuchadnezzar's return to sanity and Belshazzar coming along, and then the next scene wherein we have Daniel encountering the lions. So Belshazzar was the descendant. He's sometimes referred to as the son of Nebuchadnezzar. Reality says he's probably grandson. He might be a descendant, maybe not the literal son. It was perfectly common practice back then to refer to somebody who might not be the actual son of somebody great, but to refer to themselves as a son of such and such a great person. It was a means by which someone would associate themselves with greatness and align themselves so they would be seen as cast after the mould of that great person. If you look through biblical history, look in the Kings and Chronicles, some of the kings are referred to as being as a son of David. Well, not literally his offspring, of course, figure of speech. Belshazzar was son of Nebuchadnezzar and like him in many, many ways. Clearly, there are lessons that Belshazzar had learned, that Nebuchadnezzar had, which is clearly that of giving honour and praise to the God of Israel. The story starts out how Belshazzar held a great feast, and we read in the very beginning of Daniel how when the captives were brought out of Jerusalem and into Babylon, how many of the treasures of the temple were taken with him. Belshazzar's decided, we'll get him out, we'll have a party, we'll enjoy these things, and again, just show how great we are here in Babylon and how great we are above any other possible god. So we find that Nebuchadnezzar eventually honoured God, realised his sovereignty, but Belshazzar did not. And it says in the very end of that story of the writing on the wall, that it says, that very night Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain. Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. Darius the Mede, again, is a character. We've got to look at the historical context here. Secular historical primary references can find no reference to a King Darius at that particular point in history. Daniel has referred to him as Darius the Mede at that point. We're going to go at the end of chapter 5 there. Refers to him as Darius the Mede, the guy who took over, who was essentially the new management who invaded Babylon that day as part of God's judgment on Belshazzar. But there is no direct historical reference to a Darius at that particular time in history. He might well have been a man called Gubaru or Cyaxerxes. There's a few other possible people that he could be. It's almost like Daniel, in writing to refer to this new incoming king, was like, oh, yeah, almost like he didn't care what his real name was. He's just, oh, another king that's come in to try and take her over again. It's almost like Daniel doesn't particularly care how much or who this new real king really is, but he's referred to as Darius the Mede, the new incoming king who has been part of God's instrument of punishment to Belshazzar, who has so disrespected God's honour by using those goblets. So he was probably a governor, as I say, referred to as Darius. And as we move on to Daniel chapter 6, we're going to have the story of how this new The new management, Darius, took over, and how he set up things to when he took over the reign in Babylon. So we have Darius, who's made a power play. He's the new management. And we read in chapter 6, I'll get to that in a moment, how he decided to keep on a lot of the original things that were there. He seems to have put Daniel, who was clearly a man who had proven his wisdom, his knowledge, his effectiveness as a leader all those years, and kept him on, and he's given him great authority. Probably didn't care very much about Daniel's particular faith. All that Darius cared about was that things continue to run smoothly. And so things moved along into a new reign in Babylon, and once again Daniel found himself in a position where he had considerable influence and opportunity to serve well and to give honour to God. I'm going to read on in Daniel chapter 6 now. Get you up to speed with the story of Daniel and the lions. It's going to be, as I say, nothing that you haven't heard already, but there's a few points in there that I'd like to bring to your attention. It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps. This is Daniel 6, okay, if you want to flick over there, read along. 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them so the king might not suffer loss. Now, Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We'll never find any basis for charges against this man, Daniel, unless it has something to do with the law of his God." So the administrators and the satraps went as a group to the king and said, "O King Darius, live forever." Typical royal salute. The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce a decree that anyone who prays to any god or man during the next 30 days, except you, O king, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, O king, issue the decree, put it in writing so that it cannot be altered, in accordance with the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed. So King Darius put the decree in writing. Now, it's kind of interesting that these guys, first of all, could find nothing wrong with Daniel. He was clearly a man who was so sold out to living God's ways, to doing his job well, regardless of the nature of those that were ruling over him. He was the guy that was humble enough to realize that the authorities that he was working under in Babylon, for whatever reason, good or bad or otherwise, God had it all in plan. And even if his king, where he lived that time, was a pagan, was an invader, Daniel still had the integrity before God to live such a life that nobody could find any accusation against him. He had the truthfulness and the character to say, I'm not going to go slack under the rule of a king who doesn't follow my ways. I'll work hard. I'll do everything to the best of my ability. And it says that they could find no accusation against him. He was neither negligent nor corrupt. You know what happens when people show themselves to be authentic followers of Christ, who show themselves to sincerely want to follow Christ and to do their very best? What generally happens is those around us will go, oh, they're making me look bad. You ever notice that? I don't know if you've ever been in the situation where you're in the workplace and you've made an ethical choice among other people and they have thought that you've done the wrong thing because it made it clear to them that they're falling short. Well, this is what had happened to Daniel. His light had shown up the darkness that had appeared in the hearts of all those around him. And what generally happens is when you do that, others around you will either get bitter or they will get better. You will either have the opportunity to influence them to raise their game, to live a better life, to increase what they do, or they will fall into what we in Australia call the tall poppy syndrome, which says if you get your head above the crowd, we're going to lop it off, which is what had happened with Daniel. They had realised that Daniel was making them look bad, that he was living with such integrity, honouring his God, and they thought, well, things are looking pretty bad for us. We're looking pretty ordinary by comparison here. Need to get rid of him. And they could realise that the only way it could happen would be through his faith, by challenging his faith, by showing that that was in conflict with the rules and the values of the kingdom around him. And so they influenced, it says here, they influenced King Darius to issue that decree that nobody could pray to anyone except King Darius. Now, the way laws were made back then, the Persians and the Medes, they would set up laws, and this idea of we set this law and it cannot be changed was there so there would be the kings wouldn't have to suffer the embarrassment, as it were, of offering clemency to somebody that they liked. They wouldn't have to be seen as subjective or flexible, that a law was a law and this is how it was, and it saved the rulers any of the problem of having to make discretionary judgments about things. It was simply, that's the way it is, and I don't have to think about it anymore. And it was normally that's the way that new laws were set up by the kings in those times. They wouldn't have to get involved directly in state affairs. They can make a decision and it stays, and they can move on to the next thing. It was, however, rather unusual in those times for any king to put themselves up there with any other deity or god. So the Babylonians, the Persians, the Medes of those times took their faith very, very seriously as well. They revered their gods, those who looked after them, very, very highly. And it was a very strange thing for any king to consider placing himself up on a similar level to one of the gods. But it happened. Clearly it tickled King Darius's ego to have the idea that he should be the only one that anybody should ever speak to, that they should only pray to him. And so this group of satraps came to him as a group, suggesting maybe, clearly untruly, that they were all united in this. But a delegation came and they set it up. So King Darius put the decree in writing. Now when Daniel learned the decree had been published, he went up to his upstairs room where the windows opened towards Jerusalem. Three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or man, except to you, O king, would be thrown into the lion's den? The king answered, the decree stands. So they go on, and I'm not going to read it in detail, but it says how the king, they pointed out to the king that Daniel continued to pray to his God, and therefore, because you set this law, O Darius, Daniel's got to die. Do you reckon, maybe a trick question here, do you reckon when Daniel heard that this decree had been passed, do you reckon Daniel had a decision to make? Thanks, John. I want to suggest that he didn't have a decision to make at that point. He had already made that decision. He had already decided that his faith in God, that his continuing communion with him three times a day was so important to him. He had already decided that this is where from his strength comes, that this is his way of showing his devotion to his God, by regularly putting aside that time, by regularly thanking his God, no matter what the circumstances, no matter what the management of the kingdom at the time. He had already made that decision that this is what I'm going to do. I think he realised that he was already in a hostile environment, where the gods that were worshipped in that place were already clearly opposed to the God of the Bible of Israel that he already followed. He already knew, and I'm sure he had already worked through the possibility that his own faith might be a danger to him. Remember the statue of the furnace? Remember how he'd been told he has to eat the king's food and be part of that? He had already made a stand earlier in his life to say, this is where I stop. He had already made the decision that his differentness, his true devotion and his faith, his regular practices that express who he is and his connection with his God, these are the things that are going to make him different. He had already made that decision in the times that were good for him, in the times where things were peaceful and calm, and when he was in an environment where he was in favour with the king. He'd already made that choice and already set those habits in a place. So I want to put it to you that when Daniel heard about this, he didn't have much of a decision to make at all. We could live in a land like where we have right now in Australia, where it's easy to be a Christian, or relatively easy. Certainly we're not in any danger for what we do and what we believe in and what we say. There are places in the world where it's a little bit dangerous to be a Christian, where to proclaim the name of Jesus will get you into trouble. But how hard is it to be where you deliberately make a step forward to say, I follow Jesus, I believe in the one God, and to deliberately put yourself in the firing line? Not easy. Very few of us, thankfully, will ever have to do that. But in a figurative sense, in our day-to-day life, there'll be a lot of times where this decision you make today, or made a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, where that decision is what will hold you through to the day where the challenge is put to you. Are you really going to continue to show that devotion to God? And the question will come up, where is the line? What are the things that are not negotiable to the way that you live out your faith in Christ? For Daniel, it was regularly communing with God three times a day. It was living a faithful life and serving effectively, letting no possible hint or appearance of corruption be seen in what he does, to be conscientious and follow through so that no fault could be found, except to prove how his faith, how the one God that he followed, is different from everybody else. That's where he drew his line. To say, this is the truth and nothing else works. So Daniel had already had a precedent that he was praying. He'd been doing it for years. He wasn't trying to make a point to say, well, I refuse to pray, so I'm going to pray anyway. He wasn't deliberately putting it in the face of those who were trying to impose the rule of that all must pray to to Darius. He just went on as business as normal. And our effectiveness as we serve God will come from those deep places within our life, from the resources we gain when we follow God and when we listen to him in the good times. Stephen Covey, who wrote the book The Seven Habits of Effective People, and opinions on him and that view will be mixed, but what he makes is a very good point. He says there are no public victories without private victories first. We will never, ever make a good impact for the world as we follow Christ without that first making an impact on us. Within ourselves, with those habits and those beginnings that we make, are really the groundwork for where we will then be remembered. Daniel is remembered because he continued to do what he set out to do. He finished as he started by continuing with those regular habits of praying three times every day. And that is what gave him the strength and the effectiveness, where we remember the fact he is the guy that kept on doing what he started doing. He continued on. He's certainly remembered for his ability to interpret dreams, to grant wisdom, but for so many people it is his faithfulness, where he said, it doesn't matter what everybody else thinks about God, it doesn't matter what other practices are imposed on me, I am going to be this way. This is my differentness that will make me a witness for God in the rest of the world. So Daniel continued on doing what he said he would purpose to do. So the story goes on. They went to the king. The king gave the order and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, "May your God who you serve continually rescue you." The king noted that he continually served his God. Right? Not this God that you serve, but you continually serve. Darius spotted that Daniel's devotion was in every aspect of his life without ceasing, without a moment. Not just on a Sunday, not just on those particular holy days, but he served his God in every way. The king clearly was distressed that he had to do this. He clearly valued Daniel's work and what he did. It says that he made every effort to save him until sundown. It says also, by the way, that Daniel did not pray at that point to be protected from the lions. It doesn't say anywhere about him praying, "God, please rescue me." It certainly put that Darius hoped that his God would. But it doesn't say that Daniel wanted to be rescued. Daniel was quite happy with whatever situation that God had brought him to be. Mike mentioned, and I think it was last week, the change in attitude that Nebuchadnezzar had talked about, how what God could possibly rescue you from my hand? And he finished by saying, acknowledging the sovereignty of God, that he was able to rescue Daniel and his friends from his hand. Same question arises here. What God could possibly rescue Daniel from the exposure to the lions that Darius had put him to? This again also was actually not an uncommon means of punishment and of testing the gods in their day. It would not be that uncommon for somebody who proclaimed to follow a particular god, they'll be exposed to some particular danger, snakes or lions in this case, to the wild. And the expectation was, well, if your God's real, let him rescue you from this danger. We're going to put you in. It's not that uncommon a test for the faith of a person to be exposed to danger and to find out if their God would rescue them from a natural hazard that they've been exposed to. Exposing Daniel to the lions, well, let's find out if your God is any good. It wasn't anything particularly reserved just for Daniel. It's the way they would do those things back then. And we read there that the stone was placed in the mouth of the den. The king sealed it up. He returned and spent the night without eating, without any entertainment, and without sleep. And he got up and hurried to the lion's den. So clearly, in spite of Darius's hard-nosed rule that says this is what's going to happen because that's the way the law worked back then, King Darius clearly cared for Daniel. Not just because the fact that he was an effective leader and a ruler and one of his subordinates in the kingdom, but he clearly had an affection and a connection with him because he's a guy who has been very effective in my kingdom, sure, but so much more. He was much more moved about Daniel's possible fate than if he'd simply been somebody who was one of his best leaders in the kingdom. And so, as we read on in the story, as you well know, the first light of dawn, the king got up, hurried to the den. When he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, "Daniel, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions?" And Daniel answered, "O king, live forever." This is the same king that sent him to the lion's den, yet he still gives him that praiseful greeting, "King, live forever. I respect you. I serve you as the king here." He still gives him that royal greeting. He says, "My God sent his angel and he shut the mouths of the lions. They've not hurt me because I was found innocent in his sight. Nor have I ever done any wrong before you, O king." This would be the typical phrasing of vindication that somebody in those days, you know, Harris said that people would be exposed to danger to see if their God was able to help them. That is the way that the words of vindication that Daniel was able to proclaim. There would have been a familiar way of saying, "Yep, it's true. My God has saved me and rescued me. I was found innocent in his sight and I've never done any wrong." It says, goes on, verse 23, "The king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him because he had trusted in his God." And then at the end, there's a bit of justice gets served, perhaps. He goes on, King Darius finally learned his lesson firstly about the sovereignty of our God. King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations and men of every language throughout the land, may you prosper greatly. That's the king, hoping that the land prospers. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian, who was the next successor after that again. King Darius finally realized the sovereignty of our God in spite of any other attempts to punish him, in spite of attempts to show that to follow our God is in conflict with effectively serving this world. And Darius finally got the point to show that in spite of the devious plans of those who were against Daniel, that he would be proven vindicated, and through that, God's name would be honoured. Did you notice that in this decree, it was all about the God of Daniel, not about Daniel himself? That in doing God's work faithfully, that Daniel was able to elevate the God of his people, the God that he followed, the God that we followed, so that all would say, this is a God who can save. And he rescues, he does signs and wonders. Daniel didn't get any credit for it in the eyes of Darius and his people. For us, the goal should certainly be that our God should be honoured because of the great works that we do. As I said, what will happen, however, in our own lives day to day is that we will find situations in our life where it's going to cost us a little bit of something, sometimes a lot of something, to follow Christ in the world that we have. There's a cost to being a disciple of Christ. We have to give up certain comforts. We have to give up time that we would spend for enjoying ourselves. We have to give up being accepted by some people. Because what happens is when we speak God's truth, it will challenge the expectations and the comfort of those around us. There's a phrase, and I use it every now and again. It has been described to Luther, but it wasn't actually by him. But I love this phrase anyway. It says that Jesus came into this world to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. I reckon that's great. I reckon that is just so spot on, that those who are afflicted, who are in suffering and in pain, God is close at hand to those who are in danger. He's close at hand to those who are suffering and who are suffering from injustice. And yet he also comes to afflict those who are comfortable, who think they've got it right, who think that they can use and abuse other people, force power on others, who can dismiss truth and justice. And God sends his spirit to, and people like us to afflict them by pointing out, hey, that's not right. Daniel's very presence as a man who lived with great integrity and truth and hard work afflicted those around him by showing up, hey, I don't measure up here. I want to make it very, very clear though. It is not our perfection, much that we would strive towards living a Christ-like life. It is not any kind of sense that we are right and others that are wrong are what's going to make the difference. The way we live in humility and in truth is what's really going to make the difference. We know, I think you figured it out already, that none of us are actually perfect. That as we're going to see our lives compared to those of many others, they're going to look at us and go, oh, you're not perfect. No, we're not. Clearly not. The impact that we're going to make, the challenge that we're going to have on other people's lives is not through a perfection of conduct. It will be through the process of becoming, of striving to have a character that is honest, with integrity, with hope, with something higher than us to believe in. And that will show up the difference between what we believe in, who we trust, as compared with those other things that people put their faith in and their trust in. And every now and again, our very actions will challenge people. Every now and again, it takes our words to challenge people, to say, sorry, but you got it wrong. This is not the way it is. The truth is, we do no favours to people if we let them carry on in a belief system that is not going to help them. If we let people continue with false ideas about the gospel, with false ideas about what life is like, we do them no favours. And the challenging part within us, the cost that we sometimes have to pay as disciples of Christ, is to risk that relationship we have with someone and say, that's not true what you think. The reality about God is this. The reality about Christ is that all this other stuff is not true, but there is only one way to God, through the life and the death of Jesus Christ. That's a challenging thing. The cost you might pay for that is to alienate a relationship you have. The price you might pay could be even worse than that. And some people are very deeply entrenched in their ideas and will, instead of accepting an idea that the truth of the gospel, they will reject you. Sometimes your family will do that. Sometimes close friends will do that. It's a cost to be a disciple. Nobody knew, or very few people knew more about the cost of being a disciple than a guy just before the Second World War named Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Some of you have heard of him. He wrote extensively about suffering and about what the cost of discipleship is. He was a guy who was part of a conspiracy that almost succeeded in assassinating Adolf Hitler. He was eventually killed for his faith. One phrase that he used that sticks with me is that he says, when Christ calls a man or woman, he calls him to die. Pretty morbid stuff, but the point he's getting at is our own life is no longer our own. The cost is we give up the things that please us and to tickle us. Sometimes it's giving up some relationships for the sake of him getting the glory through what we do. It's hard going sometimes. Daniel had to face up to that. We'll do it in many ways in our lives. Maybe there is a situation you're in right now at home, in a family life, in workplace, where you're not too sure if you think, should I confront this person about something? Well, it's between you and God how that's going to play out. But the story, as Daniel goes, is that he prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian, who was his successor. Daniel spent many years living in the land of Babylon, serving and living a great witness for the way that he spoke for his God and how he was faithful as one who worked hard. If you want strength for the hard times, the time is to invest spiritually now during the times where things are easy. The regular habits, the things we do, I'm not going to say that we need to do Bible study or pray more often. What I'm trying to say is that if a challenge is going to come, you will be able to respond to that challenge if you have already made that decision. Let me urge you to make whatever decision that you need to make about how you follow Christ. Make that decision sooner rather than later. Let me urge you to think about what areas in your life that you want God to make some changes in you. Make that decision sooner rather than later. Because the opportunity may come quicker than you think. You might be challenged when you're not ready. I know I would rather be ready for a challenge that God puts before me by investing in myself now. I hope you all do the same.